I'm going to go ahead and call the High School Redesign Work Group to order. Those of you in the audience, first of all, I want to say thank you for you to you for coming out on this cold, chilly night. And also, of course, I need to thank members, too. Some of us even drive long distances to get here, and that's quite a commitment, especially on a very chilly night like tonight. But those of you, back to those of you in the audience, in the past, if you have not been here, we've invited those in the audience to come down and sit at the tables. It just makes for much more of a better conversation and a better atmosphere, in my opinion. So I'd welcome all of you to come and grab a chair around the table. But I won't mention that there are some of you who refuse to take a chair around the table. We have, like, reserved seats and are not flexible. That's all right, Ms. Schwab. You stay where you're at. In fact, don't come down to the table. Last week, we gave a little bit of an intro as to what we were going to do tonight, and we do have some people here from Representative Swales District. So at this time, I'm going to turn this over to Representative Swales, and she is going to talk a little bit about what's going on in her district and the people that we have invited here today and why. So, Representative Swales, would you please take over the meeting?
Thank you, Representative Dietrich. I am just so fortunate to not only live in a community that has the kind of people that we have in it, but to work for the school district that I work for, which is South Washington County Schools. And this year, we were so fortunate to hire Mary Ryersey, who is a Minnesotan but has spent the last several years living in the state of Washington. And Mary was hired as our curriculum coordinator for the district and brings with her such a wealth of expertise and such a gracious spirit, and she's one of these people who is so incredibly humble as well as talented, and it makes her incredibly easy to have as part of our school district because she has already made some amazing inroads. Our school district right now is getting ready to build a new high school, and the high school is going to be state-of-the-art in terms of technology and a lot of the other things that, you know, from the wish list of schools. But one of the things that we realize is that the culture of high school also needs to change. And Mary's expertise in the state of Washington, she helped with a program called Navigation 101, which there was legislative support, and there was also financial support by the state and foundations, and she'll explain all of that. So I'm very delighted to introduce her this evening. The other person that is at our table is Mr. Paul Simone, who is the principal of the Math and Science Academy, and this is a wonderful charter school that is also housed in Woodbury. And I have been fortunate to be there for several events and occasions, and I always kind of have to sit here in the legislature sometimes and shake my head when people say, we need to have a state math and science academy, when in my own backyard we have a wonderfully successful school that does that very function. And Mr. Simone is a man with tremendous vision and has been there from the ground up with this facility and with these students and with these families. And I could not be more proud of a school than I am the Math and Science Academy. In fact, we were just chatting on that February 1st. I need to be at the Math and Science Academy at 7 o'clock in the morning to help Mr. Simone judge some bills that are being created and written by students in their social studies department. And so that will be a lot of fun for us to do together. So I will stop talking, but I please everybody welcome them, and I hope that you find them as wonderful and engaging as I do.
Representative Swales, may I suggest that we have Mr. Simone first so that we can continue to work on the technical aspect? I think those two over there are like on the brink of a solution.
I know, I dropped Lou on the telephone.
Yeah, I think we're close. So, go ahead.
Mr. Simone, if you would like to... How do you want to do this? Do you want him at the testifier's table?
Oh, I can talk really loud right here.
Well, and he's speaking to the microphone as well.
As mentioned, my name is Paul Simone. I'm the director of the Math and Science Academy. I was fortunate enough to be one of the founding teachers of Math and Science Academy. And when it comes to redesign, I have to say that I take that quite literally because that's what we did. It is a matter that I don't have a presentation per se, but I do have some comments, and I do have to say that the comments that I will make today I've made before. I've been fortunate enough to have the House Education Finance Committee come out to the Math and Science Academy. I was extremely fortunate last year, inasmuch as Governor Pawlenty brought the Governor of Arizona, Janet Napolitano, out to the Math and Science Academy last year. And so the comments that I have, I've made before, and I will be blunt, they're not always very endearing, because it always seems like what I say means that somebody else is doing something wrong, and that's not necessarily so. When it comes to redesign, for me it does mean from the ground up. It's sort of like if you're going to redesign your house, it means more than just painting and putting a new carpet. What I gave as a handout is our business plan for the Math and Science Academy. It's a meta-analysis by an author called Kathleen Cotton, who compiled information on small schools. And so when it comes to redesign, it's architectural, it's environmental, it's cultural, and even reaches to governance. And everything that's in this meta-analysis is applied to the Math and Science Academy, meaning higher test scores, meaning more parent participation, meaning more participation of students in extracurricular activities, meaning higher parent satisfaction, and it all revolves around small schools. In other words, this was the scaffold upon which we hung our marketing plan, and our marketing plan is our curriculum, math and science. And in 1999, when we opened, it wasn't quite a hot topic as it is now, but it did turn out to be quite a hot topic. However, I'd have to probably say that whatever curriculum we hung on this scaffold would be just as successful. And not necessarily having really a presentation, I do much better with questions and answers. And so anything you'd like to know about the Math and Science Academy and about designing a Math and Science Academy or a school similar to that, I'd be more than happy to share with you.
Well, since I've been there, I'll start. One of the events that I attended was a parent meeting where they were approving student projects. The parents had raised funds, and then they were supporting students in a variety of projects that some of them they were traveling around the nation. I was wondering if you could explain a little bit more about the parent involvement and why that is such a cornerstone of what your school is all about.
Parent involvement is part of the governance of a charter school. Meaning, we have a board of directors, and it's mandated that the board of directors is populated by parents of the students in the school. And keeping it small means that not only do you have to participate if you want the school to be successful, but your participation is real, as opposed to just sort of perfunctory. You're having an effect on what it is that your kids are doing, not somebody else's kids. And our parent team is a member. Our parent team is an official committee of the board of directors. So if you look at it in the light of site-based management, that's really what it amounts to. We have parents and teachers on the board of directors as mandated by charter school law, who are then charged with developing policy and running the school, which in reality is that's site-based management. But it's not site-based management in as much as the decisions they make get reviewed, per se. It's sort of like the decisions they make are the ones that get implemented and are the ones that are carried out so it has a far more meaningful sort of effect, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions too. So, I might have been handing out papers when you addressed some of this, but so the part of the scaffolding here is that you have small schools. How big is your school?
300.
And what would be the option if those kids didn't have this charter school? What size school would they be going to? What are they choosing against?
Geographically, where we're located, our two biggest draws are South Washington County and Stillwater, so 833 and 834. So their options would be Stillwater or South Washington County. We do bring in a handful from North St. Paul, Oakdale.
And what are the sizes of those high schools?
1,900, it was very...
Stillwater probably has 22, and then North St. Paul, Oakdale is comparable.
And so what is your class size?
Our class size is roughly about 20. And it actually goes beyond class size. It really is school size. Because of the school size, you see, you're in a class of 20, but you will always be in a class of 20, and the teachers that you have, because we don't need that many teachers, you will have 2 or 3 years. And so it's a matter of, even as director, not having any classes, I still know all of my students, because the building is just not that big. And that type of environment lends itself toward a great deal of social control. If everybody knows you, you will behave much better, so to speak.
So, being a charter school, your fund, do you have outside funding?
Not other than the formula aid.
And so what makes your school then a math science school?
Our curriculum and our graduation standards. For example, you will not graduate from the Math and Science Academy unless you've completed a math program through calculus. You will not graduate from the Math and Science Academy unless you've completed high school biology, chemistry, and physics, in addition to our other graduation requirements, which includes language through grade 11, which include American Lit, World Lit, Brit Lit, expository writing, and the full complement of social studies. So literally it's our graduation requirement that makes it math and science.
Mm-hmm.
If we were in arts and humanities, and we've talked about trying to create a partner school, we would just change the graduation requirements. We would probably include things like Latin, and we would include other, you know, core subject areas that fit with the arts and humanities.
So you've talked a lot about the social aspect of it. And it seems to me like you were at least alluding to that you have a less behavioral type issues that you have to deal with. What about the academic? Are all kids prepared for that level of rigor in math and science? And if they are not, what happens?
They're not all prepared. And the Math and Science Academy is not the perfect school for everybody. And unless you are thinking that math and science is going to do you well either in your career, meaning you're going to go into that at the post-secondary level, or if you find that succeeding at something that's extremely difficult is valuable to you, you probably won't stay at the Math and Science Academy. In other words, we take in about 65 sixth graders a year. We graduate about 30. We're not the best school for everybody. And that's why we wanted to look at, and we had looked at, creating our humanities. Our goal would be, quite honestly, to just get large by staying small. Create a campus similar to the University of Minnesota where you just have specific schools for specific subjects that would be appealing to everyone. Because math and science isn't for everyone. But as far as a hot political topic, you bet. And do we have good math scores? Yes, we do.
Mike, how good?
For the past 3 years, we've had the number one math scores in the state of Minnesota. Last year, we were second to Mount Spark Academy. The state of Minnesota, for the past 2 years, had bragging rights with regard to highest composite ACT scores. I think it was like 22.3 out of 36. Ours are 28. And the difference, of course, is ACTs and SATs are taken by a self-selected population, the kids who want to go to college. all of our kids take them. So that would be a measure for our entire school, not just our best and brightest.
Your average was 28?
Yeah.
Not bad.
We're actually pretty proud of our kids. And some of that's by design. I mean, we teach that as a class. And
you teach what?
ACT and SAT and TSAT prep. And we teach those as classes to teach them how to take standardized tests. And then those tests, the ACTs and the SATs and TSAT, generally go through what they expect 10th grade math curriculum will be, which is geometry. Well, our kids have also had pre-calc and calc. So that gives them an advantage. They've had two more years of math than, you know, generally the average student who takes those tests.
How many classes a day for the children now?
Six. They take the five core courses, math, science, English, social, Spanish, and then each student gets a non-core course, whether it's band, art, health, speech, computer programming.
Do you have, I know with a lot of the larger high schools, the advantage that they have is that because of their teaching the masses, they can you know, offer the core program and then have many alternatives. You know, the choices are more. Would you consider your high school then to have a little bit more of a limited choice selection, or how do you handle that? You can't staff to student ratio. You, financially, you can't do it, can you?
No, we can't. And when it comes to economy of scale, it's just a matter of being creative. For example, at the high school level, most of the electives are taken at the 11th and 12th grade years. I mean, you very seldom are able to take electives in 10th grade because you're still doing all your requirements. Our 11th and 12th graders go PSEL. About half of my 11th and 12th graders go post-secondary enrollment. So they're taking courses at Century College and University of Minnesota. So when parents will ask us, well, where do we get all these other classes? And, you know, my kids are interested in this, and they want to do this, and they want to do that. You don't have that variety. So maybe I should just go to a larger high school and get that. And we tell them, well, you know what? It's tough to compete with Century College when it comes to variety as well. And when I say half of my juniors and seniors, it's sort of like a quarter of my juniors and three-quarters of my seniors. So that's helped tremendously so. And we don't necessarily worry about the loss of revenue, being that the revenue follows the kid, because we're fortunate enough to have a waiting list, so every student that goes PSEL opens up the spot for somebody else to come in. So our actual enrollment is about 325 or 330, but we have about 300 in the building. And going PSEL is a tremendous advantage, as much as you not only do college credit, but you get to explore career and occupational types of things. And they don't even have to be college-oriented stuff. We've had a number of students who will take interior design because that's what they're thinking about doing because they finished their graduation requirements. And so whatever we can do to facilitate that is just part, we consider that part of our program.
Now I have one more question, and that is you talked about it being a school for those who might have the goal to be in some sort of math science type occupation. What do you do for kids to help them explore the math science occupations when those are changing so quickly?
Our science teachers have plugged into a couple of great resources. Our life science teachers, a member of, and plugged into the science museum and those programs. Our chemistry and physics teacher is plugged in with the University of Minnesota. In fact, he's going to be taking our students out to the University of Minnesota to tour their labs. Mm-hmm. And for us, a field trip is real easy because we're only taking 50 kids. We don't have to load up busloads and take them out there. And organizations are far more inclined to bring small groups of kids. And for us, it works out real well, and it's real easy for them to do. Though it is interesting about, and this is just an informal guess, about half of our students stay at our school in spite of the fact that we make them take so much math and science just because they like the small size. In other words, they won't go into math and science. Our past three National Merit Scholars have gone into journalism, acting, and I think last year's is still undecided, but it's not math and science. And they're just thrilled that they don't have to take any more math and science.
Do you know how your graduates do? I would presume very well, but I just have to ask. On the entrance exams for placement in college, or how they do in college in math and science once they get there? I would presume very well.
I would too, and I have no actual data. We've had 6 graduating classes, and what we do track, however, is that the most important thing for our graduates is being able to go wherever they want, and that's what they've been able to do. And parents who will say, well, I don't think my student really wants to go to college, so why should I send him to a college prep type school? But in reality, the message is, if you're prepared for college, then you're pretty much prepared for whatever you need to do. And so the most important thing is for them to be able to go where they want to, as opposed to being limited in that aspect.
One of the things that we're talking a lot about at the state level are the 4 R's: rigor, relevance, relationships, and so forth. One of the things that I'm very impressed with at your school is the robotics team, and as I mentioned, these students who came before the parent board with projects, taking them to places like Denver for a peace conference and all the different things that they've done. Can you help me put into context, because I feel that it's very present at the Math and Science Academy.
Oh, dear. Sorry.
Focus. What kind of activities do you do that help the young people feel this is relevant, I can see myself in the future, I feel focused towards something because of what's happened in your environment?
It's really whatever they want to do. In other words, they bring all that stuff to us and we just make it possible. For example, the reason the parents can sit down and do this is the parent team or the parent committee, it's not a PTA realistically, is an official board committee. So what the board has done is said, you can go ahead and raise money. And they do. They ask for a $50 donation per family every fall. And that's all they do for fundraising. And then we said, now you get to spend that money as you best see fit. And when it comes to opportunities, it is literally whatever the kids bring to us. We didn't sit down and say, because we're the Math and Science Academy, we're going to have Lego robotics. We had a group of kids who said, you know, we'd like to have Lego robotics. And we said, okay, what do you need to make that possible? And it's the same with our first robotics, which is sort of like Lego robotics for the senior high, but you have to build an actual robot that does something besides drive around track. Those kids, as they grew up, said, well, now we'd like to do something more. Okay, well, what do you need to make that possible? And because it's such a small environment, there really isn't the bureaucracy or the paperwork to go through other than just sitting down and making the decision and then saying, okay, we can do that. And so the encouragement to go into these things literally comes from them. In other words, rather than saying, well, you know what, we can't do that, the answer is generally, well, what do you need to make that happen? Because we can do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like you to spend some time, if you would, you'd be filling out this role of parents. You mentioned they're on a board of directors and so, and that students will present ideas or proposals to them. What other kinds of things do they do as far as governance of the school or other activities?
Charter school law requires a board of directors of parents and teachers who work in the school. We have, and it requires it to be a preponderance of teachers. We have 5 teachers and 4 parents. The size is literally decided upon the school. If you have a school of 100 students, that might be too big of a board. If you have a school of 500, that might not be big enough. We decided on 9. It's an interesting relationship in as much as the teachers can do whatever they want because they have the majority vote. However, the parents have the most important vote because they get to do that with their feet. And if you can't work with your parents will get up and leave, and if your parents leave, you take their students with them, and if your students leave, you don't have a school. So it's a relationship where after 9 years now, most everyone has come to the understanding that there is not such a thing as a we, they. There can't be. When you're sitting there on the board, and when you're a parent at these meetings, your perspective has to be what is best for the organization, not what's necessarily best for my kid, or what's best for the parents, or what's best for the teachers or the students. It's the realization of what's best for the organization, because if the organization doesn't exist, then you don't have a role. So, and it took a while to get to that point, and it wasn't something we started with, and you know, everything from salary negotiations to deciding how to spend the money, should the money be spent on the teachers, on the students, or on the parents, or on doing, it's what's best for the organization. What does the organization need? What will make it better? And you can come to that kind of an understanding because you have one single interest, and that's it.
I'm sure.
Yes,
and Speaker, you had mentioned that, for example, the board of directors would ask parents for a $50 investment at the beginning of the year. You did mention also that taking students to Denver or so things. What other kinds of financial commitments are parents making then? $50 would not send too many people to Denver. I just got back from Phoenix, and it cost more than $50.
No, in fact, we allow the kids to do their own fundraising. In other words, if you want to do that, this is what the cost is going to be, so you'll need to do the fundraising. Last year, we have a May term program, and we stole the idea from the University of Minnesota that during May we just teach seminar courses, and one of the seminar courses was European Studies, and the kids went to Europe. And it was a matter that, you guys want to go to Europe? This is what it's going to take. This is what it's going to cost. And if you went to the state fair, it was probably one of our students who helped park your car. And so they have to do, you know, the students do that kind of fundraising because, well, if you want to do it, we will organize it. What do you need to make it happen? But you're going to have to do it.
Yeah, I'm sure. The reason I'm asking the question is one of the things one always tries to look for is how to upscale a successful program. This is a program for 300 or so students. We're dealing with many thousands of students in the state of Minnesota. And I'm just wondering whether a school such as this one would be possible for parents of moderate or even lesser means.
I think so, because our standing rule when it comes to fundraising is you're not fundraising. In other words, when the European kids went to fundraise, they didn't fundraise as individuals, they fundraised as a group. And everybody shared equally the amount of money that was raised. So that's just a matter of how you want to organize those rules. And then we do have a provision for anyone free and reduced to get scholarships for whatever it takes.
And the fundraising that was done, was that monitored in the sense that young people were raising these funds through employment, such as the state fair, or did any of it come from contributions from the parents themselves?
All the money came through the state fair and garage sales, and it all comes to the Math and Science Academy. And then we write out a single check to an entity. So in other words, all the money, and we tell them that all money raised on behalf of the Math and Science Academy belongs to the Math and Science Academy. You just have to trust that we will allow you to do with it what we said you could.
The reason I'm asking that, sir, is that when we think of extracurricular activities in many of the school districts now, there are very large contributions that parents and families have to make for their son or daughter to be in, say, skiing or hockey or football or other kinds of things. So you're suggesting then that none of that is needed in your school.
It is and it isn't. For example, we have a cross-country team. We have a baseball team that competes at the Minnesota State High School League level. And again, those activities are based on either what we budget, what they fundraise, and what parents pay for fees.
Madam Chair, can I continue here? One of the other issues I just kind of like to know about is the issue of special education children. So if parents of a special education child were interested in having him or her participate in your school, Are there some kind of entrance requirements?
Not an issue. Meaning, if you look at our demographic, the state of Minnesota is comparable to the nationwide. That it's about 10 or 11% of the population is special ed. That's about what we have. We have 28 special ed students. We have 2 full-time special ed teachers, 2 full-time special ed EAs, and we graduate. I mean, granted, this isn't fair because it's statistical, but on a percentage basis, we probably graduate as many or more special ed kids on a percentage basis than any of the local schools do. And special ed isn't an issue for us, meaning it's just part of our routine and it's part of our curriculum. And as far as the IEP team being able to work up accommodations for our kids, for our special ed kids to be successful, not a problem.
The reason I asked the question, Madam Chair, is I had visited a Spanish immersion charter school in one of the districts that I represent, and at the end of the presentation, someone asked one of the directors, do you have special education children? And her answer was, we hope not, because we go bankrupt. We have to have these special education children go back to the regular school setting. So that's the reason I asked this. So how are you? Huh?
That was a foolish answer.
Well, that's what you said. I don't know. Because they wouldn't have to provide, possibly it's because the school is smaller. They have about 75 students.
That could be, but I still don't necessarily see how that's a problem, because when it comes to sitting down with the IEP team, and I'm the local LEA at my school, and I go to all the IEP meetings, that's just a matter of strategy. That's just a matter of creating accommodations that work so that it levels the playing field so the student can be successful. And when it comes to money, that's all tuition billed back to the district.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a loss. In other words, the 11% of my population that are on IEPs isn't a financial drain to my school in any way, shape, or form. I bill South Washington County. If they're South Washington County, I bill Stillwater. If they're Stillwater, I mean, that's the way that's created. So that's why I thought that would be a foolish answer. That's,
well, I'll go back and ask them again. And I'm sure this. The reason I ask is we have been struggling with the issue of cross subsidies. And many of the public schools are under a great deal of pressure because of the growth of special education. So, and some critics of charter schools have suggested that they do not take their fair complement of children who need special services. But you're saying that your charter school does.
That matter. My enrollment, and I've been extremely fortunate in that, my enrollment has always been greater than, not always, but the last 7 years, certainly greater than the space I have available. We started our open enrollment period January 1, and as of today, I have about 240 enrollment forms that will somehow fill 60 to 70 spots.
Mm-hmm.
The law requires that I conduct a lottery. So, it's a Microsoft spreadsheet program to randomize that will select the students that come to my school. And if it's a random selection of kids, I expect about 6 to 7 each year to require special ed services or to come with an IEP, and that's just the way it goes.
Sure, good. Glad to hear that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome. Thank you. Any other questions?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just curious about the schedule that you run at the school, whether it's typical 8-to-3 day, whether you're going, you know, whatever the average number of days is a year now. I know that there's not a mandatory number, but are there extended day services, or do you have year-round school?
We've talked about year-round school. We don't. To a large degree, because our day is dictated by our busing, and our busing, thank heavens, has been taken care of by South Washington County because that's the district in which we reside, and they've been very good at that for us. We go 7:40 a.m. to 2:10 p.m. Our buildings open from 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. We do have extended services for some students, and geographically we're right next door to the YMCA and Woodbury City Center. And we lease the YMCA for our FIED program, which entitles our kids to use the YMCA whenever they need to during the 9-month school year. So between us and the YMCA, we haven't had really any issues with that. And as far as partnerships goes, that's been one of our best.
I was just interested in what you were saying about, well, it wasn't necessarily a waiting list, but when I first met you, you told me that the population of your school is 300 plus. And would you tell me what the number on your waiting list is?
It'll depend upon where my enrollment is. My open enrollment period will close in February. Well, as of today, I have 240 or so enrollment forms. I'll take in about 75. I'll probably end up with 200 plus on the waiting list. And that'll be grades 7 or 6 through 10. We don't get a large number of 11th and 12th graders enrolling.
And I do know you have a special accommodation for siblings of students. Would you explain that as well?
Charter School Law 124D10 allows for sibling preference. In other words, if I have a sibling in my building in 6th, 7th, through 12th grade, the ones who enroll get to go to the top of the waiting list. So, for example, I'll probably get, if it's anything like the prior years, 22 or 23 siblings. So if I take in 65 and I conduct the lottery, the siblings will be the first 20. So they're almost guaranteed space if I have space.
You know, I've heard quite a few components here to high school redesign that are very intriguing. What do you think? You're a charter school. Do you think that there is any hope? Or that's not what I want to ask. What can your model be replicated in an ordinary public school?
This is exactly what I told the governors last year when they came out. One of the original intents of charter school law was to create schools that could then be replicated in the traditional system.
Mm-hmm.
I think, quite honestly, that's where we are right now, where some of those that have been successful really need to be. And at that meeting was also the superintendent of St. Louis Park, and I made the offer to her that if you would like to do this, I'd be more than happy to share everything that I know and have done. And I don't want to pick on South Washington County because I worked there for 15 years. But I'm going to use them as an example just because I grew up there and I know the area real well. I know they're building a brand new high school. And it will be state-of-the-art and it will be beautiful. And it's going to cost $110 million? A lot.
Oh, my God.
Okay? If I were king of the world, I wouldn't create one giant high school. What I would create would be 3 or 4 or 5 separate academies. And you can do that all in that very same area, and you can do that based on, you know, sharing and cooperating when it comes to, like, athletic facilities and when it comes to, you know, research facilities. But you really, and maybe I'm just paranoid, but I don't think, quite honestly, it's wise to put 2,000 teenagers in one spot. And I don't think the economy of scale holds true for them. So that these would be the opportunities where you could replicate the smaller school models all around one single idea. And that, this might be mean to say, but South Washington County could put us out of business in 1 year if they built the Math and Science Academy. Because with their resources, we couldn't compete with what they could offer. And that would be fine if they put us out of business doing the very same thing we do. And I think that would be a tremendous trend, and that's really where my hope lies, that we have no proprietary interest over our idea. It's not like we invented this, okay? this is our business plan. This was written in 1996. We didn't start anything or create anything revolutionary or new, and we didn't create anything that we don't think other people shouldn't copy. In fact, we kind of hope they do, because that would be kind of flattering to us, and we're willing to help and to share, and that's fine too.
So let's just continue on that model you just presented a little bit. You've got my, if you were king for a day, so, and you were going to build a new high school, you would say have some shared spaces, let's just say like in a very, my children go to a school with 3,200 kids, so we're even larger than some of yours. So like take the field house type space for all the co-curriculars and that type of stuff, and have that become a shared space, which it is now, and some of the laboratory-type spaces, science, and make that a shared space, and like, well, I guess it's somewhat...
You really wouldn't even need to do that. Architecturally, it needs to be separate. They need to be in separate buildings. The dividing within the house, either by grade level or by hallway, doesn't bear out these results. They need to be architecturally separate identities and separate buildings. And yeah, the practical spaces you would share. I mean, there's no reason that each one of these buildings, if you had four separate academies, would need their own athletic facility.
Mm-hmm.
Would need, you know, even their own, say, for example, place to eat lunch. But they need to have their own culture. They need to have their own identity. The arts people need to know and need to be able to identify themselves as arts people and the science people, and it's sort of like creating interest based on what people are wanting. You know, it's kind of like our kids, we want to do this, right? So what does it take to make that possible? And the biggest criticism I've heard is that that would stratify a district, or that would stratify a high school, meaning you would have the science nerds and you'd have everybody else. But that's not necessarily so. You're giving people an opportunity to pursue what they believe to be in their best interest and what they enjoy. And it's in small enough units that all the other ancillary problems just seem to be much more controllable or don't exist at all.
Interesting concept. Thank you. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Other than the physical separation, which I agree does seem to be psychologically or whatever important for kids, when you look at the more traditional high schools and the way they operate, is it in your way of seeing this that they are that this is simply some kind of a cultural educational cultural construct that has led the more traditional high schools to stay pretty much not static, but not to go in the direction that you have with yours. What is maintaining the culture as it has been in the past? In your mind,
the notion that economy of scale is what's best. The bigger we are, the more we can offer. The problem, of course, is when you're dealing with people, one size does not fit all, and it doesn't bear true when it comes to performance.
Is it also the cafeteria-style notion, I mean, that we offer the full range of everything under one roof that also creates enormous problems? I think it is, at least.
And one of the most fascinating things, and this I mentioned to the Finance Committee when they came out, is that not only do the smaller schools tend to work better, and like I said, this was our model, but it's also cheaper. The monies that we get are about $3,000 per pupil less than what our neighbors get, just because we don't have to deal with the overhead. Would it cost more initially to start up? Probably not. It costs us $4.5 million put our school together for a 300. So for 2,000, five schools, 4.5 or $5 million each, that's still not quite $119 million.
Are there?
Sorry, I don't get. This is why I'm not really popular because, I mean, I'm not trying to insult people.
No.
I'm just trying to point out some things that I find ironic.
Not sure.
Go ahead.
Would any of those savings be a result of less of a administrative cadre?
If he did it exactly the way that we did it, would. In other words, because the parents and the teaching staff is far more responsible for many of the governance issues than an administration is, you can spend less than administration. And an example that I tell everyone is, I make $70,000 a year. That's a little bit less than I think most of my colleagues do in the large traditional districts. But that's fine with me because I don't work $120,000 a year worth. I don't have to because that's not my responsibility in building. And from a governance standpoint, I'm the only one who actually works for anybody. The teachers and the parents are on the board of directors. They hire me. So it's my job to do what it is that they lay out with regard to policy. So I work for the teachers and the parents. And it's an interesting kind of concept.
And Madam Chair, so who is the curriculum director then? I mean, in the traditional school, the principal is literally listed or considered the curriculum director of that particular school, not the teachers in the classroom. Is that your function?
Well, it's my responsibility to see to it that the things that need to get done, get done, but not to do them. For example, social studies curriculum is decided upon by the social studies teachers and then brought to the board of directors for approval. The science curriculum is decided upon amongst the science teachers and brought to the board of directors for approval. And if I'm a parent and I have a problem with the science curriculum and you're the science teacher, I will go right to you.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't work out the problem with me, then we'll go talk to the director and bring him in. And if that doesn't work, then we'll bring the board of directors in. So the assumption is that those who are hired to deliver the curriculum are the curriculum experts and are the ones who need to design the curriculum. Well, if that's your job, you better do a good job at it, because if you don't, then again, the kids are going to leave and you're not going to have a job.
I'm sure. I'm sorry I didn't find your school 3 years ago when I was in the classroom fighting for these same issues, because this more horizontal, I would say, way of organizing it,
well,
I think recognizes the fact that many teachers really are professional people who should and are able to make many of these kind of curriculum decisions and daily decisions, along with parents.
Thank you. Well, 30 years ago when I was just getting into teaching, it was an altogether different ballgame. One of the reasons that I looked at getting involved in starting this school is because it was small. I'm a social studies teacher by trade. I mean, that's my licensure in addition to being having an administrative license. But the difference I saw in the 30 years was just literally the size of the school. When I started working at Woodbury High School, they had the 7th through 12th graders up there because there just weren't that many. By the time I got done, I didn't even barely know the students I had, because I'd have 120 students for 18 weeks and then I'd never see them again.
Yeah, I know.
And for me, it literally felt like I didn't have the control that I needed just within my own classroom.
A little difficult to develop relationships, isn't it, in such a circumstance? Madam Chair, can I? How many years now has the school been in operation again?
We opened our doors in 1999, so this is our 9th year.
All right. Could you discuss retention rates of, as far as faculty is concerned?
Of the 7 teachers who originally opened the school, 6 of us are still there. And we've had 2 teachers retire. And other than that, we've done nothing but add teachers. And part of that has to do with when you give people the opportunity to decide upon their working environment and how they want it to be, it makes a big deal. And, you know, it may seem like little stuff, but it turns out and it ends up being big stuff. So in other words, if you get to decide in your classroom, and like, we're not the best school in the whole world for all students. We're not the best school in the whole world for all teachers. We've come across teachers who would just as soon step into a situation and be given, this is what you'll teach and this is how it goes. But those who would rather not, we find, are the ones that tend to stay the longest.
Yeah.
And a lot of that, again, has to do with the way we treat teachers, meaning we let them decide.
I'm sure. The reason I ask that question is, to me, this issue of engaging parents is a central issue in making schools viable again, or making them viable. And the second is to be able to recruit and retain the kind of teaching staff that makes this possible. And it seems that you've been able to hit on those two issues fairly straight on. And I would submit that high school reform proposals need to concentrate on those two items, along with the issue of size, to a great extent if we wish to make any really fundamental change. I know, when I taught at Edina High School, which is a very fine school, and we had, a lot of enriched coursework, AP, and so. But that issue of allowing teachers to participate in decision-making in what they considered to be their own professional expertise in a regular setting is very, very difficult, because people naturally who have moved on into administration feel that is really their bailiwick now, and it's difficult to break through that kind of culture.
It's hard in the large group, and it's almost impossible in the large group.
I think it is.
I have as many teachers on staff as many schools have in a single department. We have 17 full-time teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like I said, you can't create a we-they kind of relationship. It just doesn't work.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, you're welcome. I think we need to move on. Representative Wells.
Thank you, Mr. Simone, so much. And I will be there Thursday night for your open house, so I look forward to seeing your staff. Everyone, this is Mary Ryerse. She comes to us from the South Washington County School. She is our curriculum and instruction coordinator for the district, and was hired from the state of Washington. She is a native Minnesotan, and we are delighted to have her here this evening.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me okay here?
Mm-hmm.
All right, and we're going to be flexible in the spirit of rigor and relevance and how did the results happen. I know sometimes they work better than others. And so we are going, I apologize that we will not have some of the color, and really the biggest downside is what I have to share, I feel very passionately about, and the results with kids and parents and families in terms of making high school make sense are incredible. So the challenge with the technical difficulties, really the downside is you don't get to hear directly from students. I have a DVD with some students who participated in Navigation 101, and that's the downside. The rest of it, we can go with it, and we'll be flexible. So I hope that some of my experiences in Washington State and what we have done there on behalf of students and parents and families in terms of helping make high school and actually the entire school experience more relevant for them, I hope that it is something that might be considered in terms of how it might impact how people think about high school redesign here, because I think high school redesign all over the country has a lot of energy, and I really commend you as a state and commend us, now I can say back in Minnesota, for taking this topic seriously and looking at it. And truly, whether you go to and I just, in preparation for tonight, some of what I did was review and the different initiatives that are happening nationally and happening locally. And whether you call it 21st century skills, whether you call it high schools that work, whether you call it ramp up to readiness, whether you call it looking at the big R's, the bottom line is we want kids engaged in their learning and families as well, and we want them to be intentional about what they do. And so that is much of the spirit of Navigation 101. And I was involved with that both from a district level, as Representative Swales shared. I am currently serving as Director of Instructional Curriculum and Instruction in South Washington County Schools. I served in a similar role in a district named Mead, Washington, which is just north of Spokane, and was involved really from it was a grassroots effort where we were doing what is now called Navigation in a couple of school districts, and it grew to about five, and then it grew to the level where it's gotten legislative support and funding. So I'll share a bit of a history, and Christina, thank you for flipping through that. I think one of the questions, the first question is with Navigation 101, the initiative, the framework for thinking about things is how do we see students, and are our current high schools or our current schools built around the idea of students being a bucket to be filled or more of a torch to be lit? And I think that historically the Great American Comprehensive High School has often been more with the bucket mentality, and some of what we tried to get at with the whole idea of Navigation 101 and connecting with students is how do we kind of light the fire inside the belly to say, why am I in school and what am I doing? So the purpose of Navigation 101 is really to equalize opportunity, encourage student engagement, authentic engagement of why am I learning, why am I involved, enhance the student achievement, involve parent and guardians, and strengthen community. And I'll kind of give you a teaser with some of that in terms of student engagement. One, I will share some results of Navigation 101. One result that I think shows a bit of the success with the student engagement is when asked whether their participation in the activities involved in Navigation 101 were worthwhile, 90% of ninth graders said yeah. And we figured when you can get 14-year-olds to say anything is worthwhile, that was an accomplishment. And in terms of parents and guardians, attendance, as you will see, these are just kind of data teasers for right now. With this approach, attendance went from, at parent conferences, from an average of about 30% of parents attending conferences to, in some districts, over 90% of parents attending conferences, and with the whole focus on student planning and them understanding why they're involved in school. So I'll share a bit about what it is, but before I do, again, part of the why was, and what Navigation does is it tries to demystify what the process is for kids to go from their experiences in K-12 education to whatever they might choose to do beyond high school. And so the purpose is to demystify. And I think some of the data is very disturbing, and I'm sure as you've studied high schools, this is data that is unfortunately happening nationwide, and it often represents other barriers. But if you take a look at the social justice of the access to our college, and college graduation is one measure, I understand, of how kids do in high school. But if you look, and I think that most of you do have, I'm just going to put this in front of you. You can follow along, since I know some of these are difficult to read, but in your handouts, and if you look at the chart on the lower left, students who come from families with the top quartile of income, 75,000 and above, almost 80% of them complete four-year degrees. And if you go down, you can see the bars going in the direction such that students from poverty are completing four-year college at about a 15% rate or less. And you can't tell me, I don't think any of you would want to believe or do believe, that that is representative of the level of intelligence of the students that come from those families. And that inequity in terms of the completion was part of what got this started, this whole idea called Navigation, is how can we get the information? Some of that, we believe, was an information gap, is that these kids didn't know what courses, what rigorous courses they needed to participate in, or what the Bill Bagot, an education reformer, calls it the club of those of us who have completed college, have gone through that. We've shown that we can go through the college application process and can help our kids do the same. And again, this isn't just about college, but this is one measure, and you can see the inequities with it. All right. Interestingly enough, some of what I did coming here, moving here from Washington State, did a little comparison in terms of what do we really want. And I think nationally and locally, the goals are very similar in terms of, if you look at the state goals in Washington State, responsible citizens, contribute to the economic well-being, enjoy productive and satisfying lives. You look at that in terms of Minnesota's investment in education, the goals are very similar. We want students to have a strong work ethic. We want them to have employment. I think we want them to have employment in an area where they care, pursue lifelong learning, and become engaged citizens. And so I think the goals are very similar, not just in Minnesota or in Washington, but also nationwide. And you look at the rigor and the relevance. You also look at some of the initiatives. I think it's interesting to have a context, and then I truly will get into what is Navigation 101. I think some of this context is hopefully helpful. In Washington State, with the high school, with the reform, there were three new graduation requirements in a culminating project, high school and beyond plan, and a certificate of academic achievement, which there means you meet standard on, it would be the MCA, meeting standard on the MCA. In Minnesota, I know that, I don't know what, I know that it's more on the stage of here are some recommendations or some considerations as we've convened this group, and Governor Pawlenty has talked about the idea of personalized learning plans, post-secondary education, giving students option in school, and I think one of the biggest tricks is, with these goals, how do we get that information? There's a vast amount of information. How do we get it to families? And so that is part of the nut that Navigation tries to crack, so to speak. And lastly, before I get into what the elements are of Navigation 101, just a very brief history lesson. I was a social studies teacher before serving as a high school administrator and then a curriculum director. Just contextually, Navigation began as a grassroots effort in a school district, Franklin Pierce School District, which is a suburb of Tacoma, very high-need area. The success there encouraged other school districts, including the one where I came from, the Meade School District, to start to implement Navigation with students. And because of the success and because of the demonstrated results, the legislature in the state of Washington has funded Navigation for the last, this is now the second year. So it has grown to over 200 schools in 95 districts. So now, do you want to know what it is? They're almost done with the geography lesson. You can get a sense of the state. And the reason that I share the map is because I think, again, the challenge, in addition to the amount of information that's there for families to make good choices, I think another challenge is how do we find something that can be adapted to fit the communities in which our kids and families live. And Navigation, the results were replicable, whether it be the five, what are called lighthouse districts, are starred, and they represent very different communities. Franklin Pierce, highly urban, high poverty area, Bremerton, former logging town. Those of you who like Washington wine or Washington apples, if you look in the center, south center of the state, Grandview, very high migrant population. Where I came from was the eastern side of Washington, Meade, and then Vancouver, which is much more suburban-like. So the results were replicable. All right. What I will share now is just a bit about what Navigation is. And what I would typically do is share the DVD that I have where students that we created, where students describe what each of these elements of Navigation mean to them and what it looks like in a school district. And so you just please use your visualization as we do in good reading instruction. We learn our visualization skills. So try to picture kids and staff and parents engaged in these activities. So there are what is considered five key elements of Navigation 101. One is focused on personalizing, and whether you use the word personalizing or use the word relationships, you've heard a lot, I'm sure. You've probably used breaking ranks in some of the research on high school redesign, but one of the strong recommendations is for advisory. And so much of what happens in advisory is connected. I think what's unique about Navigation is how it's connected to the other activities. The second element, and I'll go through each of these, is focused on planning. And so this is where there's a lot of energy around student learning plans. How do kids and students involved in Navigation keep portfolios? So the activities that they do in advisory are included in portfolios. And then that leads to the third element, where the portfolios are shared in student-led conferences. Elements 4 and 5 are a little bit more subtle to the public. So the big three, the advisories, again, focusing on the personalization, the portfolios focus on the planning and the relevance, and the demonstrating through the student-led conferences really focuses on connecting with families. And then some of where the rigor shows up is in the scheduling. How does what kids are learning about themselves and about their future goals impact what courses they take? And then I will share with you some of the data in terms of what the results are.
I have one question.
Please.
Is this a ninth grade program, or is this all the way through the high school?
Great question. This is all the way through, and in fact, it's now started to develop elementary curriculum as well. This initiative, the state funding of it is for grades 6 through 12, so typically it's instituted in both a middle school and a high school in a district. And there are some districts now there who are piloting this in grades K-5 because of the strong response. Because what it does I'll go through the details of the elements and all that, but the gist of what it does is it puts students in the driver's seat of their education. And teachers are still in charge. Teachers still know the curriculum, but students have a voice. And as a curriculum director, spend a lot of my time and energy focusing on school improvement and improvement of academic results. And the bottom line is, we can have the best curriculum in the world, but if students don't see school improvement somewhat through their own eyes of why am I doing this, what are my interests, what are my skills, the rigor of the courses doesn't make as much of a difference if they're not engaged. So the focus here is, I sometimes refer to it as school improvement through a student lens. And so, yes, it is for all grade levels and different levels of ownership from third grade up to high school. And in fact, when we had a kindergartner, poor kid, he was a guinea pig. When the first years that we were doing this in our district, my husband and I had a kindergartner at home, and they said, Brent, you're going to do a kindergarten portfolio. And to hear him, and so I talked about student choice, but when it came to our own son, that was a mom said we're going to do this. But to hear him in his own words say, here is something that I learned from, and why, and here's why I'm putting it in my portfolio, because I learned how to research when I did this, to hear it in their words is very powerful. This slide I will just share briefly, just so you know that this wasn't just kind of invented. This is based on best practice. I just included a couple of the very key guiding documents. The American School Counseling Association has standards. And so much of what navigation says is, in addition to us having reading standards, math standards, there are standards for this whole idea of guidance. And who am I academically? Who am I personally, socially? And who am I in terms of my interests career-wise? So it's based on much, much more, and many of the documents I'm sure you've researched as a group are also included in this. And the other piece that I think is some of the beauty of navigation is not only that it is student-centered and focused, connects families to the school experience, it is also based on these standards that I mentioned from the Ask the School model. Okay, I'm going to throw this up here for a second. The beauty, some of the beauties in the simplicity is that there are three strands in terms of guidance standards. And not many people think of counselors and guidance, I think, often as being the core mission is the academic mission of the school. But that is one of the key pieces of guidance, is do kids know why it's important for them to succeed academically. So the organizing question around that, so the portfolios that kids keep, also model these three strands of the academic strand, career strand, personal social. Again, you can translate it and say academic would be the rigor strand. Career would be the relevant strand. Personal social might be the relationship strand. And what are the results? So these are the themes that recur throughout the navigation curriculum and throughout the portfolio and throughout the student-led conference. So I think it's important to see that undercurrent. And if you were watching the video, you'd hear some kind of snappy music to help you remember those three. But I will promise you I will not sing to you to help you with those. All right. We can go ahead and go forward. I will touch on, and please do a, feel free to ask questions as we go through here. I would like to try to do my best without this video to bring some of these elements to life. The curriculum delivered advisory. And you've probably heard in high school redesign about many schools implementing an advisory. And the trick, I think that the uniqueness of navigation, before I get into the key elements, I think is how it's bundled. And I can't have come from Washington with Microsoft in the back door of Washington. Microsoft did well with the concept of bundling, with things like putting together Microsoft Word and PowerPoint and Excel. Much of what navigation does is it provides an organizing structure to bundle how do advisories, portfolios, student-led conferences, all of the information we need for post-secondary success, how do we put that information together in a way that makes sense? So schools who are implementing navigation do have advisory periods. And typically schools go into what's called an assembly mode. And those of you who've been in the lives and walls of high school, every period gets shortened by about 8 minutes. And so for some schools it's once a week, for some it's once every 3 to 4 weeks. And so this whole idea of implementing navigation as a tool to help kids think about their career plans and their life goals is that we, quote, stop business as a school for, call it even just 40 minutes every 3 weeks, and say we're going to focus on you, your goals, and your plans. And so it's a reasonably low impact but high result approach. And again, the curriculum is organized on the ASCA standards. I would call your attention, there are two handouts that you have. One is the the PowerPoint slide.
The other one, if you'd like to see more detail, you can tell on the second page of your handout, it shows you a little bit about what do we mean by a navigation curriculum. And for those of you who really like to study the nuts and bolts of what does this mean, this document shows the different lessons. This curriculum right now is organized around 20 lessons with essential questions connected to the state standards and with activities such as goal setting, doing career inventories, researching interests and goals, creating, if we talk about a personalized learning plan, the personalized learning plan is created in these advisory sessions. And to the far right, you can see the student product, where they have an academic inventory or information on their career setting. And guess where those go? Into their portfolio. And where they are shared publicly with parents is during the student-led conference. And so it's all connected together, and students will base their registration on some of what they've learned. And so instead of, some people call it an academic prep to get to rigor. So every student must, I mean, get to calculus, get to calculus. In some ways, this is more of an academic pull. We say, oh, so you want to go to, you want to be an engineer. Well, let's do some research on what it takes to go through schooling to become an engineer and work backwards. So it becomes a pull for a student to say, oh, I might not love calculus, but I need to take it because I want to be a veterinarian or because I want to be an engineer. And so it helps them connect their long-term goals with what do they need to get there. I will add to with advisory, and I think there's one more, before we go to the portfolios. One of the pieces here is as we think about changing schools, a big piece is, and the earlier testimonies we heard as well, is what is the teacher role in this? And I think sometimes there are so many things that get piled on teachers, and teachers' jobs are incredibly challenging and incredibly important. And so part of the thrust of navigation was to say, all right, we do need everyone to serve as an advisor. That does not mean you need to be a career expert. It does not mean you need to have memorized what the requirements are for a student to get into an apprenticeship program. What it does mean is that you need to care, and you need to be able to follow a very clear plan for an advisory session. And so I think for some of this, in addition to demystifying the process for parents, I think it takes some of the stress off of teachers to say, and part of what Washington invested in is saying, all right, we'll create the lesson plans for advisory. We'll keep it a one-page thing where, yes, would it be good if a teacher who serves as an advisor spent 15 to 20 minutes before each advisory preparing and really thinking and connecting to his or her own life? That would be great. But truly, the part of the point was that this is engaging for kids and doable for the adults in the system. Because I think that the lack of information that parents and families and kids have about their how what they're doing in school can be relevant and connected to their future, I don't believe is because people aren't trying. I think guidance counselors are working incredibly hard. I think teachers are working incredibly hard. I think that there are some systemic pieces where some subtle changes like, oh, we'll all stop business and take a look at this, and we'll all engage with parents and listen to student-led conferences. I think I really think that there's the power in that, is recognizing that to make it doable for the adults in the system and very engaging for the kids. And in fact, as I mentioned, I wanted to make sure that I'd done some reflecting on how something that worked in one state, if it's transferable to another state. And I thought, you know, there is so much literature on high school redesign. And navigation is not the silver bullet. It's not the only answer, but what it does do is help bring a lot of pieces together. And I think part of the power in it is there are all sorts of online tools to say, okay, well, I'll help you plan for your future. You can do this or that. But what navigation does is it takes and pulls together and operationalizes and says, we're going to create a space. We're going to create the underlying structures where these conversations can take place with kids and where that exploration can take place. So whether you call it operationalizing or institutionalizing, I think it's more than the curriculum or more than any one approach. It's saying we're going to connect these things for families. All right. So that was a lot about advisory. I'll share a bit more about each of the other elements, and also want to be sensitive to the time. Questions? Should I keep going?
No, go ahead.
Okay. In terms of portfolios, I already mentioned that those are organized around the AFSCA standards. The students organize their work, reflect on their performance, and they share these at student-led conferences. So the portfolio, it's much more exciting, again, when you can see some of the students holding up their portfolio and you see how they've personalized the cover with some of their interests and their goals. And then what's inside would be some of, oh, I took a career survey. What did it say about me and what do I think about that? And include some reflection. That would be an example in the career section. In the academic section, a student would include his or her MCA scores. I think it might be surprising to people to know that some kids don't really know how they did on their MCA. I mean, they don't, if they get mailed home and talk to parents or hand it out, sometimes kids don't even know, oh, this is what I need for graduation. So sometimes just formalizing, having it part of a portfolio and having them verbalize in a student-led conference, I did really well here, or I didn't and I need to do something to help myself improve. There's power in those words. And then another piece is that students have a place for them to share some of their extracurriculars and some of their schoolwork. What a student did in their advanced placement English class, just as an example, they might choose an essay that they're particularly proud of to put in that portfolio. Another key element, and I think, again, I share this as an example of one item in a portfolio because I know that there is a lot of energy around this nationally about what is the power of a personalized learning plan. And so a hallmark piece of evidence within a student's portfolio is a learning plan, or what's called in Washington, the high school requirement is called a high school and beyond plan. So who am I? What have I learned? What am I taking in high school? And what are my plans for after high school? And so that's really a hallmark element that is built upon. It started really in grade 6, and then it becomes a bit more sophisticated each year as a student goes through there. And then the third piece is the student-led conferences, and this is just absolutely, I cannot capture in words much. I can tell you one or two stories, and I will make them brief, about the power of student-led conferences, but this is where parents come, and if you, it's just amazing to see if parents are asked, will you fill up if you can hear your son or daughter and learn something more about him or her, guess what, they come. And some of the data I'll share with you does not have the informal piece of data, which was one night when I stood, and you can just picture a high school that you know, picture kids and parents walking in, looking nervous, looking uptight, looking like, oh, why do I have to be here? And then leaving. Then they go and they do their conference, about 20 minutes of this time where they're sitting with the advisor and the students and the parents, and the student really is in charge. And students get to share some things that they're proud of and some things that they've learned. And then picture them leaving the building, literally high-fiving the principal on the way out, hugging parents. I mean, I never know when it's going to happen, but every single time that I speak anywhere about navigation, there's some point where I get goosebumps or I get choked up. And it just happened there because I was picturing a young lady who came to a student-led conference 5 years ago in our district where her mom didn't show up. And we asked her afterwards. And so I got pulled in as an adult to listen as if I were a parent. And he said, after they said, Amber, why didn't you come to my conferences tonight? You know, your mom didn't come. And she said, I know. So, well, Mr. Preston told me I had to be here. Well, Mr. Preston was the assistant principal, who also happened to be her advisor, so she thought she'd have detention or something if she didn't come. I said, well, really, I know that you came for some reason more than that. Why did you come? And she said, I came because I wanted to be heard. And so for her to have a place, this whole piece of reverence, and I think sometimes we feel that around our, at least I do as I drove up tonight to the Capitol, and the reverence around the political process and the reverence around the fact that we have elected officials making decisions on behalf of our community. I think there's a reverence in saying we're going to listen to students tell their stories and tell their dreams and be able to share, here's where I messed up and here's where I have promise. And so there's, you know, a piece of this power is in the curriculum and learning about what are my post-secondary options. Another piece of this is how the heart comes out when we say we're going to stop business and listen to kids speak about their goals. The research on rigor is pretty clear. If kids complete up to, especially there are some courses that are called gatekeeper courses, in the trustee report they're identified as chemistry, physics, and algebra 2. Kids who complete those are successful in college at a 68% higher rate than kids who don't. And so we know that a big piece of this is how do kids make decisions about courses. And we know that kids will always make some decisions based on who is in my lunch period or what is my friend taking, but we also hope that they're making decisions based on some of their future goals. So the schedule, a big piece of this, and often, again, if you have that picture of yourself in a thing where there are student-led conferences, kids conferencing with their advisor, parents there, oftentimes schools will set up computer station so that there is a registration process immediately after SUNLIG conferences, so that parents aren't just, sometimes parents feel like they're a bit shoved out of the conversation by high school, but sometimes the registration actually takes place right there. And now probably what you would really like to know is, does this work? How do we know if it works? In addition to the stories, because I could tell a whole bunch more of those about, you know, a controlling father who saw his son actually include an F math test in his portfolio and share. And the dad just about came out of his chair during the student-led conference, and the son said, "Hang on, Dad." Showed him the next paper was an A-. And so he said, "I learned something because I knew I studied for this test and I didn't for the first one." So I could go on with stories like that forever, but you know, some of that is, those are anecdotes, and how does that influence how we make decisions about policy, how we make decisions about what we expect of students, and those are important, and yet I know that we need to tell more of the story, and I think that some of that happens as we look at, the data indicators of how has this been measured, because it would not have received legislative funding in Washington State were there not some measures of the success. So go ahead and you can go to the next one. And I will share in graph form some of the results that navigation has yielded. One here I referenced earlier, that a conference attendance, you can just get an idea. These are the five White House districts, the average attendance being below 30% when they were the typical arena, I call them arena-style parent-led conference or parent-teacher conferences, which there is a place, and I'm not suggesting that that the current structures of conferences are completely irrelevant. There is still a place for a math teacher to sit down with the parent and the student and say, here's where you're going. Some of what Navigation presupposes is that there are interventions for kids who aren't succeeding academically, so which is why I say this is not the only answer. This has to be coupled with strategic ways of making sure that kids are achieving. But you can see the attendance rate dramatically increased to less than 30% average to approximately 80% average in terms of good parents come. A next piece of data, I referenced the student information. If you can look here and say, were parents satisfied with their conference experiences? Over 90%. And the informal poll that I didn't share, I asked parents one of those nights when my principals were high-fiving on the way up, did you learn something new about your son or daughter tonight? With one exception, every single parent said yes. And some of what they were learning on were aspirations and things that they needed to be planning for as a family. And so that was the big piece. Gatekeeper enrollment, and this is something that I worked with a school district in New Jersey, Paterson, New Jersey, and I don't know if any of you have ever been there, but incredibly high need, incredibly high challenges, and they've had some pretty scary data about the kids who are involved in the more challenging courses are definitely the kids who come from more affluent families, and some of what happens to the enrollment is particularly this slide shows that kids who are from poverty actually increase their rigorous course-taking patterns at a higher rate than the others after the implementation of Navigation 101. And then I think that one piece that I've heard some discussion about in the state of Minnesota, I also had the privilege of hearing our Speaker of the House, Margaret Anderson Kelleher, speak recently and talked about the connection, the importance of the connection between pre-K, or I mean this committee is called E12 for a reason. And I don't think it's because it was a miss on the K. So for the early childhood, all the way up to post-secondary, and what are the connections and the links that we're making? Because we can do a lot within our K-12 system, but if it's not connecting outside of that, it's not as powerful. So in the post-secondary enrollment, you can see this is a comparison between the Franklin Pierce School District and the enrollment in community college. And after the implementation of Navigation 101, Franklin Pierce, which had been a long ways below the state average of community college enrollment, so you can see steadily increase to actually exceed the state enrollment in community college. And part of that was because kids were getting the information they needed. And then a big dollars and cents question, in addition to the satisfaction, we need to look at how many kids, and this is an indicator that's often referenced in the conversations about high school and reform, is how many kids are needing to take remedial classes when they go on after high school. And it's more than we need it to be. What you can see in this data is that the number of students needing remedial math decreased after there had been more information again on how am I doing and what do I need to be successful.
Representative Brown has a question. Go ahead.
Okay.
I'll wait until she's done.
Oh, Well, and I can wrap up, right? I mean, I think you've seen the data. I've got some other kind of concluding remarks, but I would want to make sure that we stay on the schedule and answer the questions.
I'm looking at the different programs that are involved in this, and they all are just wonderful. And what I need to say is that I've experienced the majority of them in different schools and for different periods of time, including the advisory and the portfolios and the student-led conferences. And this is all great stuff. But what I want to know is how that you've managed in this program in its entirety to sustain it over time, as opposed to being a principal's flavor of the year.
Mm-hmm. And that's a very good question. And I was on the telephone yesterday with a colleague from Washington who talked about that. I mean, even in Franklin Pierce School District, the district of navigation, there are challenges with making sure that it sustains and stays fresh. But much of it is working with advisors, working with students, and I think oftentimes it self-perpetuates with the student-led conference where so much of it comes together and the kind of the aha things happen and the data comes in. But much of it is revising the curriculum each year, is making sure that it's adapted. I mean, I think the most important point that I really have not made yet is because it happens on a micro level and it happens on a macro level. It's one of the big... Because what we do with students, the decisions that we make as adults reflect the values and of what we believe happens with students. And so an example of that is if we believe that this whole experience should be personalized for kids, it also needs to be personalized for school districts, and it needs to be personalized on a state level or a national level. This isn't something that, I mean, well, there have been people who have inquired about navigation from state to state. It might not look exactly the same where it's implemented each place. And so I think part of that sustaining question is making sure that the districts who are involved in this don't necessarily just say we're going to take the cookie cutter, navigation, do advisory once every 3 weeks. They might need to personalize it and connect it to some programs that are already existing and strengths in their school. And so it has, I mean, it survived the district where I came from. It survived four different superintendents. It survived a principal who happened to be a dear friend of mine who said, Mary, over my dead body, will we do advisory? He ended up going on to be a superintendent in a different district, and guess what was the first initiative he started? Navigation. And so some of it was the results did, because I think people adapted it, and because of the training, that was what helped to sustain. But it is a challenge.
I'm sorry, Mary, go ahead. I thought that was, we were going to have a question on a specific slide. So go ahead, finish up.
Well, I think that is, I could think that the parent, we talked earlier in the, how do we connect parents meaningfully to their kids? And I think that this, with the power of the student conference, this is a one way to do that. And so the parents become part of the plans. The parents, I don't think that we're in a society where we can just assume that families have conversations about who are you and what do you dream to do and how can we work together. And I think that we need to equip families with the decisions. So the parent involvement is a big piece. And then I could go on and on about this, but I mentioned this earlier, that we can focus on the academic rigor and we can focus on the relationships and we can do it separately. But if they're together, the power of the hope for kids is amazing and for families. And I think that it turns into, when people are connected, I know that a pilot I met said, you know, Mary, it doesn't feel like I'm going to work every day because I love what I do. And if we had more people in the world who knew who they were and what their interests are, I think that is a key to the success. And whether you talk to that pilot or you listen to Ruby Payne, there's a piece that I won't read to you, but in your handout, where Ruby Payne, who is well known for her framework for understanding poverty and impacting education, just talks about the focus on planning and what we owe to our kids and families who come from unpredictable environments, so that we can say, you know what, your future is important to us and we're going to make planning part of your experience in K-12 education.
Excellent. You know, that's so funny. We were just having that conversation earlier today, is that even those of us who thought we were going to be highly qualified to help our children choose a college, choose a major, get through that process, just feel so inadequate when it comes. And you're right. I think we haven't spent enough time reflecting on these things. And even in the best of families, I think you think you're going to spend a lot more time on those types of discussions than what in reality you really do.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Yes, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, I assume that this is being instituted in South Washington, right?
You know what, that I shared that when I was hired there, is I will come and I will serve as a resource with this. I know we asked about sustaining and we asked about success, and a big part of sustaining and a big part of it being successful is that there's buy-in and that it is something that a district has decided to do. So there have been, in the process of high school redesign in South Washington County, I have been asked to share in some different places a bit about navigation. So I come here from South Washington County, but I'm not going to force navigation. I mean, if South Washington County may come to that conclusion, but I'm not sure yet.
Madam Chair, the reason I'm asking is I noticed that the Washington State Legislature funded navigation and twice now.
Yes.
Were those funds necessary for startup, or are they necessary for continuing such a program?
And the funds, and that was my role just prior to working at South Washington County Schools. I was statewide coordinator for Navigation 101. I actually did that from our telecommuted from Woodbury to Washington State last year and awarded some of these grants. And I think once you hear the amount, it was only $10,000 to many districts. And so it's not a lot of money, but what that allowed was basically, for the most part, that paid for teacher time. So they were startup funds. Some districts had done startup funds through smaller learning communities grants, and typically what districts needed most time with was to have time for teachers or leaders, building leaders, to write the curriculum. But now that there's a curriculum that's open source, online, available to all, it's really more adapting and leading each grade level. So, you know, with some small teacher stipends to lead that or make it part of counselors, some counselors are often leaders. The biggest expenses are the three-ring binders, and yes, should there be electronic portfolios? Absolutely, but in terms of the technology to do that. So the funds were intended as startup funds, two-year maximum, and most districts found a way. Once school boards saw the results and the positive voter support, I think that they found ways to support navigation locally.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Benson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Any other questions? Any questions from anybody? Anybody in the audience have any questions?
I do have one comment. I was fortunate to see the video that that shows the students actually engaged in these student-led conferences and hearing parent response to it as well. It's, you know, you just long for sometimes when you're in the classroom to see the students shine. And to see their parents really appreciate their children. I mean, that is just an overwhelming thing when that happens. And this video, just over and over and over again, showed these students just taking control of the future. And they were so proud of these binders. They are, you know, they are their history, and there's pride in presenting these things and sharing these things. So, for me, I've never been in a school that has done this, and I would welcome this as a teacher. I think this would be an amazing step forward to have this kind of student ownership of what they do in school. It's just a comment.
Yeah, I would like to just comment on the student-led conferences. Before a couple of lives earlier, I was a fifth and sixth grade teacher, and we went to student-led conferences, and I think Mary, you hit the nail on the head when you said empowering. Mm-hmm. It is truly empowering. And it doesn't come with a lot of work and structure, like you talked about. You did a lot of role-playing and what do you do, what don't you do, and all that type of stuff. But the students are really empowered, and there is no secret why parents will enroll their children in baseball and soccer and all that type of stuff. It's because they love to watch their children perform.
Yes.
And they will go to a conference, and they do walk out of them just beaming with pride to watch their child take control of their own education.
Yes.
Something we're all striving for.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, the state of Washington is very fortunate to have you, and now I would like to speak on behalf of the state of Minnesota. We are now very fortunate to have you in our state as an education specialist, so thank you for coming tonight, and welcome.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate being invited here. Thank you, Representative Swales, and also appreciate the folks from Minnesota Department of Education who also, I know, are committed to the high school redesign. So
absolutely.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Next, we are going to go back in history a little bit. We had, the High School Redesign Committee had focused one evening or a combination of two evenings on career and technical options within the high schools. And at the time, we did not have the next speaker come just because we thought we were going to hear from some different career technical programs in the state, because we continue to, anytime you talk about career technical programs, everybody always brings up the STEP program immediately. And I thought, I hated to just bring up the only example of career technical programs that, when that program happens to be from the school district I'm from. But after a few weeks, I realized that we can't really close up this conversation without inviting Ginny Karbowski, the director of the Anoka Hennepin Secondary Technical Education Program, to talk about technical education in the high school and the model that they have designed there in Anoka Hennepin that gets kids involved in career technical program during high school. So, Ginny, thank you for coming on such late notice.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
But it's wonderful to see you again.
Great. Representative Dietrich and members of the committee, I'm Ginny Karbowski, and I'm Director of Current Technical Education with the Anoka Hennepin School District, and I'm also Principal of STEP, which stands for Secondary Technical Education Program. And I'll be honest with you, it's been really fun to listen to both presenters beforehand, because so much of what I am experiencing and living every day is some of the things that both of these presenters have talked about. STEP is a high school and a college setting. We are actually located on the Anoka Technical College campus. And as we talk about the three R's, rigor, relevance, and relationship, I want to add a fourth, and it stands for key partnership, because, and I'm going to honestly say that I believe this is a key part of the future for current technical education, and truly is what I would consider part of high school reform. STEP is right now 6 years old. We opened in the fall of 2002, and in any school day, any given day, we have about 900 11th and 12th grade students that are coming from our five home high schools, Anoka, Blaine, Champlain Park, Coon Rapids, and Andover High School. About 100 of those students are with us full-time, taking their academic coursework, and then the other 800 are taking a career class for half a day. So they come to STEP for half a day, and then they go back to their home high schools for half a day. Our enrollment has grown 2.5 times since it opened. So we started with a group of about 350 coming in a day, and we're now at about 900. And we're pretty solid with that number. That's been a consistent number now the last 3 years. It's about 15% of our students, high school juniors and seniors. So we believe we're taking that, I'm going to identify the crew of the applied learners, the current technical education students that is ready for more than what our high schools are offering. We consider what we're offering is advanced current technical education. And with that, we do have 20 different career programs. And as I say to the teachers, we need to be one step ahead of the students. And we try to provide a high-tech, rigorous curriculum that's not only focusing in on the career and technical education portion, but we're also focusing on applied academics. We are integrating math all over the place at STEP. We have applied reading. We have applied writing. Our students do research. We are definitely what I would consider to be rigorous. Our students call our classes challenging. And for those of you that have worked with high school students, I don't always know. I know that our students don't always say that our coursework is challenging. Project Lead the Way is an important part of our programming. We have engineering, we have biotechnical engineering, aerospace technology, computer integrated manufacturing. Those are key parts of our program. What kind of a student attends STEP? Our district statistics are actually mirrored in our STEP program. We have 22% students of color, and we have 14 students with disabilities. And as I mentioned earlier, it truly is about 15% of our total high school 11th and 12th graders. We've done an analysis of our students' grade point average, 4.0 to less than 1.0. So we have the gamut of students. And we really do believe the majority of our students are probably in that middle group. And as I have always felt, that is the group that I would like to be working with. It's that good, solid high school student that probably needs to have a little bit of encouragement in their learning. They don't always love to sit still. They don't love the larger classroom, class sizes, and they'd rather be doing. And I hear that a lot. One of the reasons why they like to be at STEP is because of the fact they get to do. And so we do have students that are definitely planning to go on to 4 years college. We have students that are planning to look at community college or technical college. Our goal is to encourage them to go on to college. We truly believe a high school diploma is not enough anymore. And so college, college, college is in our daily announcements all the time. In fact, today I gave a special announcement letting them know about scholarships, encouraging them to look at financial aid, where we don't talk necessarily about the athletic scores at the home high schools. We do focus on college. That is kind of the tone of what we talk about in our classrooms. 100% of our programs are matched with a college program. We work with the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. We work with Anoka Technical College, but we also work with all of our other MinSTU partners. And so all of our students have the opportunity to earn college credit. If they come to STEP as a junior and stay with us through the senior year, they can earn up to 15 college credits. So they're at a point where they're able to get almost a semester of their coursework done. All of our courses, as I mentioned, focus on the applied academics, and we're actually going to be working a little bit more on that to focus especially on the applied math to help our students in the MCA2 scores. It's going well at STEP. Thanks to what I would consider strong support from our school board, and I want to just mention that Representative Dietrich was one of them that was a real strong leader in beginning STEP, and really appreciate her leadership in that, along with the current school board is continuing to talk about that. We have a great superintendent who's supporting STEP, along with our other district administration. Our high schools are supporting us, our community supports us, and our partnership with the college. And that, to me, is a key part of what's different about STEP, is we are on a college campus. We share facilities, we share curriculum, we share equipment, we share supplies, we share resources of time and dollars. There are even times where we share staff. And I think that has been a key piece. When we started 6 years ago, I would not say that. Today, I say that's the part that makes us different. And I think that and we have many tours to come to STEP. And that is one of the things that I do emphasize is the importance of connecting with our higher education partners. That seems to make a difference for our students and our parents in the community. We really are proud of saying that their son or daughter is going to college. And that is something that we really try to make an important part of their programming. In this day of high expectations for all students, I think that is also one thing that has bumped the level of rigor for our programming. And I think part of it is our students come to STEP and they think they're going to college. And so the culture is different because they are in a college setting, and their attitude seems to be different. And it's just something that, again, has been something that I've realized over the last 6 years, that is a key piece of what is happening at STEP. We are also showing these students that they can go to college. We're showing them that they can do challenging coursework, and they can be successful. It's different than PSEO. We really do know that we are a transition program. Just like you go from kindergarten to first grade or eighth grade to ninth grade, we are that transition program between high school and college. And so our high school teachers are working with our students to build that confidence. Yes, you are smart. Yes, you can go to college. Yes, you have the talents and abilities to be successful in college. And hopefully what's happening at the end of them sitting or taking a course at STEP is they begin to believe in themselves. Their parents begin to believe that they can go on to higher education. And so I think that's one of the things that we really continue to work on with our students. We also show them that a technical education is valuable. If any of you have taken a tour recently in the workplace, it is high tech, high skill. And personally, when I look at some of the textbooks that our students read, I don't even know what the words mean. It is high skill, high tech, and I think we have to value what is today very much so where there's good, livable wages in very many highly successful jobs. And so that's one of the pieces that we focus on. In my 30 years in education, I have worked predominantly in current technical education, and I guess many people would still use, and I don't like to hear this, but they sometimes say the old vocational education, but I will tell you that it's different today. Current technical education is not only the skill base, but it's also theory. And when you get into industry certification, when you get into the college credit with technical education, it is difficult and it is rigorous. And it is something that we can be proud of that our students are taking. So we talk about the three R's of rigor, relevance, and relationship. We talk about the 2+2+2 initiatives, 2 years of high school plus 2 years of technical or community college plus 2 years of four-year college, such as the Minsky Centers of Excellence, which has been a great activity that we have been part of because of Anoka Technical College. We are working with the new Perkins legislation, which has wonderful goals that are geared towards exactly what I've been talking about earlier. And we are working with other school districts. We are encouraging them to come to Anoka Hennepin STEP, look at what we're doing. We have about 1 to 2 tours a week at our school. Other school districts are coming to see what we're doing. I am personally working with other school districts. I believe that we need to have more STEPs across the state. They don't have to be called STEP, but that kind of a model where we're working with our higher education partner. And so we have many teachers that come and we share our curriculum with them. We have administrators come. We sit down and talk to them about some of the things that we think are important to keep in mind as they look at models in their particular school districts. It can be small school districts. It can be, you know, city school districts where we get the wide gamut of different kinds of school districts, and there are different models that we think can work. But there's a couple key things that we think are important. First of all, they need to be offering the college credit within those current technical education courses. They need to be connected to a higher education institution. And our MNCU partners have been wonderful as far as working with us. And so that is one that we definitely talk about. Secondly, and of course I push this, is that there does need to be some college presence. Maybe they can't be on a college campus, but there needs to be that college advisor or college mentor or some way that they are directly connected with a higher education institution. And then the third component that I have found to be very important, especially with our students, is intense career counseling. And what our former presenter talked about was wonderful. But with the students that I'm dealing with, sometimes it takes even more. It's going to talk to them every day. Did you get that college application in? Did you sign up for the ACCUPLACER? Did you practice the ACCUPLACER essay? Did you study so you're ready for it? Come on, let's walk over and take that ACCUPLACER test. Okay, you didn't pass it this time, but we're going to work on it and we'll practice it a little bit more. Along with that, did you fill out the financial aid for it? Did you fill out the scholarship? a lot of that kind of work with them along with their parents to help them through that college application registration process. And I mean intense. It is one-on-one. It is our teachers working with our students. It is it's guidance counseling plus teacher working with those students plus, you know, double that. It's just an intense, intense kind of a plan. Couple comments that our students have said, and these are just a few that I just picked, because we survey students to see how we're doing, and this is just one way that I can close. Chrissy says, step classes are a challenge, but they are well worth it. The structure of my class has prepared me for future endeavors. Now, we just asked them to write, so these are things that they have put in their own words. The reason I joined or enrolled in STEP is because I thought I was ready for college. At STEP, they count on you acting like an adult. And in our program, we do a few things that are what you would consider treating them like adults. No bells, no passes, you know, some of those little things that they think is just, they're really being treated like an adult. Kind of, once again, that transition to college. And this is my favorite. Corey sums it up by saying, a STEP student is in a transitional program between high school and college and enter a college atmosphere. STEP students have a positive outlook on their life and what career they plan to pursue. STEP helps students prepare for college and gives them a step into the real world. So I guess at this point what I would like to close by saying is I really believe that this has been a community effort. I truly am very grateful to our business community and to our leaders, civic leaders in the community, because they were the ones that stepped forward along with our school board saying we needed to maintain this kind of a presence in our community. And what has resulted is a very positive, very successful option for many of our students in our school district. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Jenny. Any questions?
I have a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I just want to know that when you talk about making, you know, you just have to work with these students constantly, you know, and helping them. And I can remember when our son, his final year in college, our youngest, and we no longer had to fill out the FAFSA for him to go to college. It was like, that was the happiest day of my life. You know? Because that is such a complicated document. And to think about what Representative Dietrich said, you know, it's the club. If you've gone to college and you've been in the club, you know what the expectations are. But for first generation families who have not been able to go to college, this is a daunting wall in front of them. And I congratulate you on having a vehicle in order to help that happen. We have access to Century College from our school district and Inver Grove Heights or Inver Hills. But what you're able to offer here is, I think, a much more comprehensive experience than what we're able to provide for our students by sending them up to those schools. And so I don't know if it's, you know, location, but because of where you are located, it really is wonderful that you can provide this to high school students. I wish we could have more technical colleges available, but where we do have them, I wish we could broaden the support. I congratulate you for what you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. Representative
Whale
with an S. Okay. Thank you for those comments. I really believe that this is something that can happen, not just at an Okehennepin step. And I'm really trying to work with my colleagues to show them that. There's a couple things that have to be in place. Good curriculum. And I will tell you, there's some great curriculum out there. Project Lead the Way curriculum is outstanding. It's rigorous, it's high level, it's challenging for students, it's catching them. And then the other piece is probably that whole industry certification. Those are not easy courses, programs. And then that partnering with the college. And I'm really hopeful that you will see the Korean technical education community in the next 5 years really move in this direction. And we've got to work at it, but we need to develop the leaders that are going to move this forward so that it isn't just something that's nice to be in the Anoka area, because that is what I'm hearing, and that is not what can happen. It needs to be across the state. So how we can systematize what we've got going on is something that we need to be talking about. And that is one of the reasons why I am very willing to work with my colleagues to show them what we've got going on. We have been R&D. You know, I honestly can tell you the first year, we thought we were a college, and we're not. We're a transition program between high school and college, and that's what we need. And so I think we've learned some things over the 6 years that I can tell my colleagues what's happening, and I do believe that it is something that they can take. We will continue to provide ideas for other people across the state, because I believe there's a real need for this kind of programming for many, many students across the state.
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, that was the one reason, Ginny, we just decided that even if it was the last minute, we had to have you come, is because the more I've delved into the technical side of high school redesign, everybody says, well, you've got that STEP program in Okanagan, and that STEP program. And it is truly something to be very proud of. But the question is my phone? The question is how do we replicate it? And so I guess what we'd like to do is ask you, if you could just, you know, get a list of some things. I've written down some of the notes, but if you could provide us what you think are the crucial elements to a successful program, so that if there are people that want to replicate it, if we can help at the state level.
I can certainly go through that, and maybe you and I can
sure.
work together on that. And it's interesting because Rochester, for example, has a wonderful facility thanks to the Mayo Clinic, thanks to the community. There are some pieces there that they're on year one, and I can already see we need to go and start. The teachers came up last week, and we started talking about what direction do you need to go. So it is interesting there are a number of different pieces. You can have a wonderful facility. That doesn't mean that it's going to work. So those are some of the thoughts that I've had and have noticed. So I'll definitely help with that. Thank you.
It would be terrific. Any questions from anybody in the audience? Okay, with that, I will reiterate what we talked about last week, because since this is the last meeting of the High School Redesign Work Group. And if it's not, I think Christina is going to remind me of that. If we just don't say one more person. No, this is the last evening, and I want to thank members, and I want to thank those of you in the audience for your participation and support in all of this. Once again, like I said last week, what will be generated out of this committee will be a report. And after that report is done, we will be generating some sort of a bill. And we've had one informal conversation with members here, and I don't think it's nothing that we're going to rush together for this session to make sure that we have something in this session. If it ends up coming together and it is ready for this session, we'll probably introduce it. But we are really thinking in terms of 2009, a comprehensive high school redesign bill. So with that, I will adjourn this meeting and say good night.